How are you, Ms. Foss?
Hi, good afternoon. May it please the court. Ms. Foss, I represent Mr. Robertson.
Absolutely. And the cause, I won't ask you about reserving time, but you know you have your 15 minutes.
Yes, sir. And I apologize for the number of assignments of error, but there was just a lot prepared to go wrong with this case. So I will jump right in. The court erred in calculating Mr. Robertson's income. Mr. Robertson was retired from the military. He had a retiree pay statement that was submitted in court, and Mr. Robertson testified that the income shown on that retiree pay statement was his entire income and that he did not receive any additional income other than the $3,982, I think it was, shown on the statement. Wife stated in court that husband may have additional income, that he might have additional income, that she thought that he had additional income. However, that was never proven to be the case. The parties appeared for a hearing in June of 2016, and wife stated to the court that she thought husband might have additional income. And the issue there was something called concurrent retirement disability pay. And that is, I understand, was established in 2004 so that when a service member waives part of his pension in order to receive VA disability, he can still receive his pension and not have to waive that part. And that is shown on Mr. Robertson's retiree pay statement, but he explained that that's actually incorporated into his gross pension. That's not on top of his gross pension. So the court decided to go forward with the June 2016 hearing, but stated that it could not calculate child support, spousal support, distribution of property until it was able to receive the information that wife thought was out there regarding husband's income. So the court entered two orders directing DFAS and the VA to produce any income, any information regarding husband's income. Husband's response was basically, great, that will show that it's not in addition to that. So the court went forward with what it could in June and then set the parties to come back in October. The parties came back in October. By that time, neither party was represented, and wife did not produce any other evidence about husband's income.
There's an issue about discovery here not being complied with, or, I understand your position, but, didn't your client have a couple of opportunities to present the evidence concerning this VA situation?
The only evidence he knew, from my understanding, to present was his pay statement. And so he presented his pay statement and said, this is my whole pay. Wife said, I don't think that's the case. And then the court was upset with him.
He could have presented evidence to authenticate what his income was.
He was not represented at that time, and you'll notice throughout the record that there are references to his mental disabilities. Even the court in its final decree or final order said that he was partially mentally disabled. There's references in the record to that he wasn't supposed to go out alone, that he shouldn't be making any decisions with his powers without his power of attorney, that he had memory problems. And the court, when the court said that, your discovery is deficient, the court even said to him that I told you to get an attorney. Well, the issue is, how was he to get an attorney? That's not as easy as just...
Well, I guess my only point is that, we reverse trial courts for error. And if you have an opportunity to present evidence, which arguably he did and didn't do so, and in fact didn't comply with the court's discovery order and in fact was sanctioned for it, then the question is if parties are allowed to benefit for their failure to do what they're required to do, that sets a pretty bad precedent, seems to me, which is sort of what you're asking for.
He did present his evidence. It would be the same as if it was a pay stub. If you go into the court and you say, this is my pay stub, and the other party says, I think you have income from other places, and you say you don't, she was given the opportunity to prove that her position was right. If she thought he had additional income other than what he was saying, she had the opportunity to prove that. She could have subpoenaed his bank records to try to prove he had additional income. The only evidence that the court had regarding his income...
Well, I'll just refer to the assignment of error. The first assignment of error is that your client didn't have a reasonable opportunity to develop and present evidence pertaining to his income. And it just seems to me that he had two opportunities to do so. So I'm struggling to understand how your assignment of error is established, I guess.
Yes, sir. In both hearings, in the June hearing and the October hearing, wife was allowed to go first. So in the June hearing, wife presented her evidence. That ends up getting continued to October. Wife presents her evidence first again. And then you get to the end of the October hearing, and then there's an issue about who owns a house in Chesterfield. And then the judge cuts off the hearing, tells the parties to come back in November, and you'll see that my client is confused at the end of the transcript. He says, "You mean we're not coming back today?" The judge says, "No, we'll come back in November." And then the judge cancels the hearing, and then that's it. And he issues an opinion letter. He issues a final decree.
Can I ask you on the child support? And I'm just sorry to interrupt you, but time goes by really fast and these arguments are occurring. On assignment of error 3E, in 3C, you talk about the court erred in finding husband's income was the $6,377 because of certain things that should have been deducted from his income and added into wife's based on spousal support. Also, D, you're talking about the Social Security benefits the children were receiving because of husband's disability, that should have been counted toward his. But in E, you say the court erred by failing to deduct from husband's gross income the amount of child support husband pays pursuant to an order for the support of a child who is not a child subject to the party's proceeding. I couldn't find, maybe you can help me with this, where your client ever submitted any evidence of proof of these payments, the amount, to whom they were being paid, all of that that's required by the court in order, let's say he is paying, X amount of dollars for support of another child, not of this marriage, but where is there evidence that he put on the record for the trial judge to consider that?
Judge, there wasn't evidence of the amount, you're correct, until after the judge issued the order. But again, the parties didn't think, even the wife didn't think the case was over yet. She wrote to the court in the record saying, are we going to reschedule the hearing? So he did not. The answer to your question, he did not until...
So this wasn't put in even within 21 days after that final decree? Yes, you see what I'm asking.
I do.
Was it in the bosom of the court when this information was put or could have been put forward?
I was almost positive it is. It's in the. It was within 21 days. It was in. Mr. Robertson hired an attorney to file objections to the decree, and that was filed within 21 days. And in those objections, the attorney argues that we didn't get to. He didn't get to finish the hearing, but he also argues that, husband didn't get to put on evidence that he pays $500 a month for another child. So before the 21 days was up, the court knew that how much Mr. Robertson paid. The court also knew from testimony that Mr. Robertson had another child. There is testimony in the record during the proceedings that he had a child that was not of the marriage, but you're correct that it didn't get to how much do you pay.
It wasn't timely put before the judge ruled.
It was not put to the judge before the judge ruled. Again, the judge ruled before the parties were.
But 3D, the information on disability, how much each child of his marriage was receiving disability payments was before the court.
That was, yes. In fact, wife put on evidence that the children received Social Security disability of, there's two minor children at the time, each one was receiving $310 a month for Social Security disability that derived from...
Well, one was receiving $465 and one was receiving $310. Am I wrong on that?
I could double check it. I had $310 for both. But I think that the number did change. I think at one time the child may have been receiving more and then it was reduced. So I think at one point it might say $465 and then $310 in another because the amount did change. But I think the final...
But your argument is that was not given as credit to husband toward child support, essentially.
Correct. And that's a shall. If you look at 108.2, that is something that the court must do. It does not have discretion. And when you look at the court's... order regarding child support, it says that husband's income includes disability benefits, but then it doesn't give him the credit for the amount.
Another question, if I might. On the number three says, the court erred by awarding wife child support in the amount of $884 a month. And we've talked about some of the places where that might have changed in 3C, 3D, possibly 3E. But am I correct that you're... conclusion is it should have been $883 per month, not $884.
That's not what our assignment of error is.
Okay, I didn't think so.
No. What I was trying to make the point of is that the judge did not attach a guideline to his order. He did not say that his calculation was based upon the guidelines. He just said, this is what I find the party's incomes to be. This is what spousal support is. Here is your child support number. So I think the court erred in not saying whether it was applying the guidelines or not, but I did run the guidelines, and it came out to be very close. So I was just trying to be candid with the court that although the court did not say it was pursuant to the guidelines, he probably ran a guideline with those numbers because it was only a dollar off.
Right.
But the problem with that is that the
party... Because you came up with $883.47 or something like that.
Right. So I think that... Or the parties have to assume that the guidelines were run with husband's income at $6,377. But the problem is you can't do that when there's a disability income. You have to deviate.
So you're saying that it might have been $883, but that itself is wrong because the income was too high. The $6,377 was too high.
Correct. We're not arguing that it should be reversed because it was a dollar off. Just the fact that his income is incorrect. Support would be almost nothing if he was given credit for the Social Security disability payments that the child receives. And if his income was calculated correct. The wife was awarded half of his military pension, which is to happen immediately. You enter the military order usually right after the divorce. But if his income is calculated to be the $6,377, which again, we have to guess how the court did that, but if that's how the court calculated it by adding the CRDP to the pension, then the court did not reduce his income by the amount that he'll be losing and did not add it to wife's.
And that would make the difference greater than the dollar.
Much greater. It would be over $1,000 in income added to the wife and over $1,000 in income deducted.
Can I ask you on assignment of error number 5? The court erred in valuing husband's Fidelity IRA at $16,500 and awarding wife 50% of that. Because you're arguing the value of it at the time of the hearing was only $800-some dollars, and yet the court ordered him to pay her $8,250 because of that account, right?
Correct.
Now, could it have been that the court was doing that because the statement indicates that $16,500-some dollars was the value of that account originally, right? And that at this time the value was only $800-some dollars.
Judge, we don't know why the court did that. It came out of nowhere for the parties because neither party had valued the husband's IRA at that. Wife's discovery responses, wife's proffers all valued husband's IRA at the $800 mark. If the court was going to say at some point this account had $16,000 in it, so I'm going to value it at that, we'd have to know when it had the $16,000. And there would have to have been a motion for an alternate valuation date.
I'm looking for the sheet that indicated, but on the sheet it indicates that the value of that account, if I'm thinking about the correct one here, was $16,000-some dollars, and was what had been invested in the account.
It's page 452, Your Honor, if you need it. It's in the invested to date section, mm-hmm. which we don't know over what period of time if that money was actually invested. At the time of trial, and the only testimony from the parties was that there was a certain number of shares that husband owned.
So either the price per share went down precipitously, or some money was removed out of that.
If that's what invested to date means, there was no testimony about what invested to date means, whether that actually means that money
was attributed to, or whether
that's a goal, you know, whether that's a goal that account will at some point have.
Her wife had one as well, and her invested to date was $500-some dollars, but the value of hers was only $100-some dollars at this point in time. So her value had also decreased, I noticed. But I didn't know if there was, you know, there's the allegation that wife made that he bought a house and that monies were moved around or disappeared for him to buy that house in Chesterfield. And so I didn't know if Judge Teefee had indicated that perhaps he thought the reason he was ordering half of the value to be paid was that this account originally had this amount of money invested to date, and then the money was removed.
Judge, I don't know when we could say originally was. The statement was from December of 2015, so we're talking a good bit before the parties actually went to trial and before the house, most positive months before the house would have been purchased.
That was bought in May of 2016.
And I don't think there was any testimony from wife that she thought the money from the Fidelity plan was used to buy the house. The parties all along thought that the Fidelity account was worth $800. And then the judge valued it at something that, even if invested to date, means at some point it was put in there. There was no motion for an alternate valuation date, so the court had to value that account at the time of trial. The wife would have had to produce some evidence that husband removed money from that account when it was done, what purpose it was used for, and there was nothing like that. And that was.
Your time has about expired, but I just have one general question. You're raising some interesting issues on your concept of appeal. Were these issues that you're raising properly preserved at the trial level?
Judge, they could not be when they were contemporaneous because the parties didn't know the case was over. The judge issued an order before the parties came to their last hearing. So there was no opinion letter. There was no ruling from the bench. They didn't find out that there was a reason to object until they got
the exceptions filed to the order or anything like that?
There were. Within 21 days, Mr. Robertson had an attorney file the objections, and the objections covered almost everything that we put in the brief, but I also did cite a case that says in the brief that if you do not have an opportunity to object at the time the ruling is made, then you don't even have the duty to file anything within 21 days. If the court does not give you the opportunity to object right when the decision is made, then you don't need to.
Can I ask you? You say nearly all the assignments of error were objected within the 21 days. Can you tell me what was not?
I wish I wouldn't have said nearly, but I was just trying not to be absolute. But no, I cannot think of one when I was writing the brief that I remember that this was not preserved. I think the counsel covered his counsel. I'm sorry, I didn't
interrupt. And were there contemporaneous objections at the trial to all of this?
No, Judge, because the objections were not to certain evidence being admitted, or it was nothing that the judge did during the trial. It was what he did in his order that the parties did not have any idea was going to happen. So they couldn't have objected to him valuing a life insurance policy with a cash value that there was no evidence it had cash value. So they wouldn't have known to object to that.
Thank you. One last question in that vein, following up with Judge Alston, so I'm trying to understand this. So we know the November hearing that had been scheduled was canceled. It was not rescheduled. And then basically the parties were just surprised when they got an opinion letter, or what?
That's my understanding. I think one of the parties, or they showed up to trial is my understanding, but that's not in the record there. I couldn't point to that in the record. But the wife, there is in the record a letter that the wife wrote to the court asking that it be rescheduled. And then the parties received an order. And I can tell you the client didn't know the order was coming because then it was 10 days late, and then he only had 8 business days to try to get these objections filed.
Thank you very much. We'll brief counsel. And then the next case on the docket is Patricia A. Hartman versus Oakley W. Hoggart.